God. Well, I think that's what we do each Sunday as we come here to connect with the greatness of God, to get a glimpse of who He is, to get a glimpse of His greatness, and to worship Him. And today we're going to see the greatness of God in our text, but it might be from a slightly different angle than what we usually see Him from. And I hope that we will be able to connect with His greatness in this perhaps new way that our text opens up for us this morning. To begin with, I'd like to recall a Thornton Wilder one-act play from many, many years ago called The Angel That Troubled the Waters. And this was based in the pool of Bethesda in Jerusalem. And there was the legend there that when the waters became troubled, that meant that there was an angel that was stirring up those waters and that it was going to heal the first one who entered into the waters. So there is, in Wilder's play, there is this physician who has struggled with melancholy and depression his entire life. And he periodically comes to the pool in hopes that he can be healed. So one day, the waters get troubled up, get stirred up, and he thinks, okay, now I'm going to step in. I'm going to be the first one in, and I'm going to get healed. But the angel appears to him and says, physician, draw back. And he prevents the physician from getting into the pool, and someone else gets into the pool first. And the angel informs the physician, this healing is not for you. This healing is not for you. I wonder how many of us feel like that physician. There's a condition that troubles us. We suffer from some sort of emotional wound. Perhaps we are subject to some sort of self-destructive tendency. And it seems as if we are not delivered from any of that. Maybe we even call out to God year after year, and God is apparently silent. God doesn't do anything. It almost seems as if the angel is standing before us and saying, draw back. This healing is not for you. Could it be that God has redemptive purposes for not delivering us? That's the opening question this morning. Could it be that God has redemptive purposes for not delivering us? In our text this morning, indeed, that's the case. He has redemptive purposes for not delivering Israel from the nations that inhabit the promised land. We're going to look at Judges chapter 2, verse 6, all the way to chapter 3, verse 6. You can turn there if you like. In your pew Bibles, the page number is 234. This is part 2 of the prologue to the book of Judges. As a whole, the prologue both summarizes and anticipates the entire book. We looked at part 1 of the prologue last week. Part 1 considered the perspective mostly of the Israelites. Now we are on to part 2, and that mostly considers the perspective of God. So when we look at our text this morning, part 2 of the prologue to the book of Judges, we are getting a sneak preview into the entire book, specifically what God is doing in the book of Judges, and therefore what God might be doing in our lives as well. We're going to look at our text this morning in three sections. First of all, Judges chapter 2, verses 6 to 15, where we encounter the anger of the Lord. Judges chapter 2, verse 6. After Joshua had dismissed the Israelites, they went to take possession of the land, each to his own inheritance. The people served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and of the elders who outlived him and who had seen all the great things the Lord had done for Israel. Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110, and they buried him in the land of his inheritance at Timnath-Heres in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gash. After that whole generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods of the peoples around them. They provoked the Lord to anger because they forsook him and served Baal and the Ashtoreths. In his anger against Israel, the Lord handed them over to raiders who plundered them. He sold them to their enemies all around, whom they were no longer able to resist. Whenever Israel went out to fight, the hand of the Lord was against them to defeat them, just as he had sworn to them. They were in great distress. So this new generation grows up in Israel that does not really encounter what God has done in the past. They know of what God has done in the past, but in the current time, it's sort of a distant memory for them. They've been told about it. They know of the Lord, but they don't really know the Lord. There is this generation of leaders that they have looked up to, but when that generation of leaders dies off, the new generation that comes up falls into apostasy and goes off into false worship. What we see here is that one generation is too dependent on another generation. It is looking up to the spiritual leaders of that generation and has too exalted a view of them and sort of lives off of their faith, but really doesn't make faith their own. So we have this new generation that grows up and falls away. They stopped believing in the Lord, but they started believing in something else. And that's always the case. Whenever we stop believing in the Lord, we don't stop believing. We simply start believing in something else. Such was the case of the Israelites in that particular generation. What happens to the Lord? Well, he gets angry. He is like any man whose wife goes off and commits adultery, whose wife goes off and shacks up with another man. He gets angry. He is furious, not least because it would benefit the Israelites if they stayed with him. He had this covenant with them, this holy partnership, which is like a marriage in the Old Testament. And the Israelites commit spiritual adultery. The Lord gets angry. What does he then do? He hands the Israelites over. He gives them over to their enemies. He says, you want this? You can have it. He lets them go. He lets them wander off into spiritual adultery. He gives them into the hands of their captors. He sells them into the hands of the nations who live in the promised land. And then they suffer great distress because of it. So they pay a high price for their adultery. They suffer great distress. So it is possible to become too dependent on spiritual leaders. It is not possible to become too dependent on the Lord, but it is possible to become too dependent on spiritual leaders. Oftentimes we look up at certain people and we have this glamorized vision of who they are. And we are enchanted by their charisma, by their words, by their faith. So much so that maybe we think we can live off of their faith. But you cannot live off of the faith of someone else. You can only live off of the faith that the Lord is forming in you and by yourself clinging to the Lord. When we become too dependent on spiritual leaders, we become unable to separate the wheat from the chaff, and we become unable to feed ourselves from the table of the Word. And this is what often happens when we glamorize and look up to spiritual leaders. David Roper, a former pastor of this church, said from this very spot in 1968, again, you know, I take you all the way back to, you know, the classics, right? Last week I showed you a movie from the 1960s, now a teaching from the 1960s. David Roper said the goal of spiritual leaders should be to make others independently dependent on Christ. It's a marvelous phrase. Independently dependent on Christ. Not dependent on the leaders, but dependent on Christ. As I shared last week, I took with me three interns to India to teach at a pastor's seminar, a week-long pastor's seminar. These were two interns who had graduated from our program and one who was about to graduate. And we taught the Gospel of Mark. And as it turned out, on one particular day, I didn't really plan it this way, but this is just how it turned out. We were scheduled for four teaching slots, and I realized as I'm looking at this, you know, I'm not teaching once. So all the interns are the ones who were doing all the teaching. So I sat back with the pastors, with the Indian pastors, and just enjoyed their teaching. And, you know, they just did great. And I was really blessed by their teaching, and I was blessed by them as individuals, and I could tell how the pastors were able to connect with them as individuals, but with their unique gifts and everything. And this thought really occurs to me now, but they don't need me. This thought happily occurs to me. They don't need me. And when I got back, I said, you know what, they could have done that whole conference by themselves. They really could have. These are people, men and women, two men and one woman, that we as a church have poured into. And that's one of the things we aspire to do around here, is to equip others, to invest in them, so that really they don't need us, and they are able to serve the Lord fully on their own two feet. Of course, in the context of a community which is supporting them, but this is one of the things that we aspire to do at PBC. But one of the things that happens if you become too dependent on spiritual leaders is you become susceptible to false worship. You become susceptible to turning away from the true God and worshiping false gods. turning from God and turning to the false gods. Deep in our hearts, we know that we are needy and passionate people. We know that we need food, shelter, and clothing, but we also know that Jesus' words are true. Man shall not live by bread alone. We know that we have these deep passions. And what are we going to do with our needs and passions? If we don't turn to God, we are going to turn to something else. We are going to turn to false gods. If we stop believing in the true God, we are going to start believing in something else. We are not going to turn to Baal or Ashtoreth like the Israelites of old, but we might turn to the gods of money, power, sex, success, and whatnot, the local gods that live in this area that bewitch us. What happens when we go off into adultery, when we go chasing after other gods? God gets angry. We need God to get angry. If he is not angry when we go chasing after other gods, it never meant that much to him in the first place. We never meant that much to him in the first place. The relationship was meaningless to him if he doesn't get angry when we leave. If your lover leaves you and you're not angry about it, if she goes and shacks up with somebody else, something is really wrong. We need God to get angry. We want him to get angry. In this text, he gets angry. What does he do? He lets us have our way. He hands us over. He sells us into the hands of others. If this is what you want, he says, you can have it. Although it breaks his heart to let us go, he knows that that's what he must do so that we will feel the consequences of our sin, of our choices. So we pay a high price for our sin. Sin is a raider, like the enemies of God's people in the land. Sin is a raider. It plunders us, and it takes away our humanity. So God gets angry, but he also feels compassion, and we see that in our next section, Judges chapter 2, verses 16 and 19. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of these raiders. Yet they would not listen to their judges, but prostituted themselves to other gods and worshipped them. Unlike their fathers, they quickly turned from the way in which their fathers had walked, the way of obedience to the Lord's commands. Whenever the Lord raised up a judge for them, he was with that judge and saved them out of the hands of their enemies as long as the judge lived. For the Lord had compassion on them as they groaned under those who oppressed them and afflicted them. But when the judge died, the people returned to ways even more corrupt than those of their fathers, following other gods and serving and worshiping them. They refused to give up their evil practices and stubborn ways. So now, what does God do when his people are being afflicted? In his compassion, he raises up judges who deliver his people, at least temporarily. But what happens with the people? They continue offering their favors to the other gods. They continue in this false worship. What God does to deliver them really doesn't affect their hearts because they're not paying attention to him. They are still beholden to the other gods. And then when the judge dies, the people actually become more corrupt. They become more committed to false worship. They become more corrupt in their false ways. So we see in our text so far that God gets angry and he feels compassion. He is passionate. Why is he so passionate? Because he's passionate about us. Because he's passionate about you. Thank God he's so passionate. He is a God of deep, not capricious passions, and he cares deeply about us. That's why he gets so angry. That's why he feels so compassionate. He gets angry when we're destroying ourselves, and in his compassion, he delivers us, sometimes at least temporarily, from that which might afflict us. So he hands us over in his anger, in his compassion. He delivers us. What happens then? Sometimes you experience something that seems almost like the hand of God in your life. You're going through some sort of difficulty, and then that difficulty vanishes. It seems as if God takes care of something. God vanquishes something in your life, and you feel like, oh, this is great. And maybe this creates for you some sort of spiritual high. But a spiritual high can make you spiritually lazy. If you think, oh, here I am on this spiritual high, I'm going to live off of this. You can't live off of a spiritual high because you're going to come down from it. You have to live in spiritual discipline. So we can't live on that mountain, that spiritual high that oftentimes is created for us when God delivers us in some sort of spectacular way. And when we come down from the spiritual high, oftentimes we return to our prior ways, sometimes an even more corrupt version of our prior ways. I have a friend, and many years ago, he was almost killed in an automobile accident, and I went to visit him at the hospital on several occasions, and there was this glow about him in the hospital. He felt as if God had saved him. He was driving along the road, he fell asleep, he crashed, and somehow he got saved. He was seriously injured, but nevertheless, he felt God's presence in a very real way in that hospital room, and everybody seemed to notice this about him. And then I visited him after he was discharged. I went to visit him at his home, and I tried to say, oh, it wasn't that wonderful, the experience you had with the Lord, and he wanted to talk nothing about it. He cared nothing about the Lord. He didn't want to enter into that experience at all anymore. He had come down from the spiritual high, and he remained committed to his prior ways. And in fact, as time went on, it seemed to me that he was even more committed, more entrenched in his prior ways. So he came down from the spiritual high, and he didn't learn to live in spiritual discipline. So we must trust not in the Lord's means of deliverance, but in the Lord himself, fastening ourselves to him, living not off the spiritual high, but in spiritual discipline, in the word, in prayer, in community, in opening our hearts to the Lord, in opening our hearts to one another. So in our last section today, the Lord leaves the nations that are opposed to Israel in the land. Judges chapter 2, verses 20, all the way to chapter 3, verse 6. Therefore, the Lord was very angry with Israel and said, because this nation has violated the covenant that I laid down for their forefathers and has not listened to me, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations Joshua left when he died. I will use them to test Israel and see whether they will keep the way of the Lord and walk in it as their forefathers did. The Lord had allowed those nations to remain. He did not drive them out at once by giving them into the hands of Joshua. These are the nations the Lord left to test all those Israelites who had not experienced any of the wars in Canaan. He did this only to teach warfare to the descendants of the Israelites who had not previous battle experience. The five rulers of the Philistines, all the Canaanites, the Sidonians and the Hivites living in the Lebanon mountains from Mount Baal Hermon to Lebo Hamath. They were left to test the Israelites to see whether they would obey the Lord's commands, which he had given their forefathers through Moses. The Israelites lived among the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. They took their daughters in marriage and gave their own daughters to their sons and served their gods. So the Lord ceases to drive out the inhabitants of the land in response to Israel's apostasy. And instead, he simply raises up judges who will temporarily hold the enemies of the people at bay. He raises up these judges, these tribal leaders. They deliver the people, but it's only a temporary sort of deliverance. Nevertheless, we see that the Lord has redemptive purposes for leaving these nations in the land. He leaves the people in the land in order to test Israel and to teach Israel. First of all, to test Israel, to see whether Israel will return to the Lord. You see, you have these oppressors in the land, and these oppressors oppress you, and they afflict you, and they make life difficult for you, and they can push you all the way to the breaking point. And at the breaking point, will you return to the Lord, or will you just break? For the most part, the Israelites just broke. And he also leaves the nations in the land in order to teach Israel war. There is this whole generation that has arisen that does not know war. It does not know how to fight. The previous generation saw the power of God. They saw the walls of Jericho fall. They saw nation after nation fall in the promised land. But this new generation has come up and they have not tasted battle. So they need to be taught war. The Lord leaves the nations in the land in order to teach Israel. They needed to understand not only what the Lord had done for Israel, but what the Lord could do for Israel. They needed to take up the sword. They needed to take up the sword to know how they needed the Lord, to know the power of the Lord. So ultimately, they too could know the Lord. Not simply know of the Lord, not simply know what the Lord had done, but to know the Lord himself. Alas, this generation chooses to live among the Canaanites instead of fighting against them. And even they chose to marry the Canaanites. And the Lord had warned them about this. Don't marry the Canaanites. If you marry the Canaanites, they will turn your hearts against me. And that's what happens. Today, the lesson still stands. If you are thinking about getting married, don't marry someone who is outside the faith. Why? Because in so doing, you place your own faith in jeopardy. You risk having your own heart turned away from the Lord. This, of course, is what happened to Solomon, our prime example. He married foreign women, and perhaps that's another problem, too many foreign women. But the foreign women turned his heart away from the Lord. So where are we this morning? How have we gotten to where we are? First of all, it is possible to become too dependent on spiritual leaders. And when you become too dependent on spiritual leaders, you become susceptible to false worship. When you engage in false worship, what does the Lord do? He lets you have your way. He hands you over to the false gods. He may, in his grace, on occasion, deliver you in some sort of spectacular way. But that can create for us a spiritual high, which does not necessarily mean dependence on the Lord. And oftentimes, off of the spiritual high, if we're not careful, we fall back into false worship, following the other gods instead of the true God. So where does that leave us? It leaves us in a world dominated by sin. Perhaps in your own life, it leaves you subject to sin. There is this oppressive presence in your life. There are these impulses, there are these thoughts that you don't seem to be able to get rid of. Perhaps this kind of thing has dogged you for years. It leaves us in a world dominated by sin, which God, for redemptive purposes, chooses not to vanquish. He left the nations in the land. He sometimes leaves sin, even sin in our own lives, the temptation to sin. He leaves it there for his redemptive purposes. Why? To test us and to teach us. To test us to see if we will return to him. Because false worship can break you. Oh, it is attractive, of course. Money, sex, power, success, of course, have their allure. It is exhilarating to worship those gods. That's why we go after them. But eventually, they oppress. Eventually, they enslave. Eventually, they push you, or they can push you absolutely to the breaking point. And at that point, will you break? Will you just break? Or will you turn to the Lord? That's the test. Will you turn to the Lord and worship him? Second, he leaves all of the stuff in our lives to teach us war. If there is stuff in our lives that we can't get rid of, if we seem strangely bent toward false worship, strangely, if we endeavor to worship the one true God, but seem strangely bent toward worshiping false gods, and we can't get rid of that, we have something to fight against, don't we? We are in need. What do we need? We need the Lord. We find in this spiritual battle that we fight, and that's the kind of battle we fight under the new covenant, we find in this spiritual battle that we wage that we need the Lord, that we need to put on the full armor of God, as Paul says in Ephesians chapter 6. We need to know not only what the Lord has done, but what the Lord can do. So the big battle in my life, the one that I have fought, is against this false God that continually whispers in my ear, seek validation elsewhere. Go after me. Leave God. Don't listen to how much he loves you. Don't listen to how he has created you and formed you for himself. Don't listen to and pay attention to how he has redeemed you. Don't listen to that thing that says you are incredibly valuable. Go listen elsewhere to other voices. That's the thing that I've been dealing with for a lot of years now, and I have cried out to the Lord about it, and he has not delivered me. I still hear that voice all the time. I still have to fight against that voice, and it dogs me. And so, you know, I wonder sometimes, well, I'm not fighting well enough. Or maybe God just has chosen not to deliver me at this particular time for his perfect redemptive purposes. And that's where I've landed. I said, okay, this stuff is there. I've done, I keep pouring out my heart to you, Lord. You have not delivered me. But you know what's happened? I have met with the Lord over and over and over again. And something precious has happened between God and me, something that I wouldn't trade for anything. The relationship with the Lord I have, the intimacy I have with him that has been forged through the presence of this false, oppressive God in my life, which has forced me to my knees to know that I don't have the ability to conquer this, to be able to turn to the Lord and to say, I'm here. The Lord is here with me, forming me, shaping me for his purposes. So he has not removed the false God. He has tested me. He has taught me. And because he has not removed the false God, what has happened? I have drawn near to him. In the end, the false God of false validation has served me well. And of course, in spiritual warfare, we not only fight against that stuff that oppresses us, we also get outside ourselves, outside our own thoughts, outside our own minds, in order to engage in the battle for the hearts and minds of men and women and boys and girls in this world. We take up a sword for the sake of the world, in addition to our own sakes. So we take up a sword in spiritual warfare, ultimately that we might know the Lord. Well, that's kind of not what you think about it at first. You say, okay, I'm going to get in the battle. But when you get in the battle, you find that you need the Lord. When I was 28 years old, God lit a fire under me. That's the only way I can explain it. And I was sitting in the pews for a lot of years after coming to Christ at age 16 to 28. That's about 12 years sitting in the pews. And it was for about a month in my life, it was like God got me out of the pews and into the war. And that's what happened. But here's what happened. Okay, I guess I'll do something, Lord. I'll get into the battle. So I began teaching Bible studies for high school students and college students. And when I started doing that, I found that I was insufficient for it. I found that I needed the Lord, especially on the night when I came all studied up to teach my college Bible study and no one came. 8 hours of study. I would spend an entire day. I had 2 days off a week. One of them was always during the middle of the week. So I'm going to do my Bible study. This is my job today. I'm going to do my Bible study. 8 hours. Come ready, all ready to teach. Nobody is there. I wore out a path in the park near my house that night, speaking to the Lord about that one. I found as I engaged in the spiritual war for the hearts and minds of young men and young women that I needed the Lord. The Lord taught me spiritual warfare. I took up a sword. And in taking up a sword, the Lord took hold of me. He tested me. He taught me. He did not grant me deliverance from the false God. Instead, you know what he gave me? He gave me himself. It's a song that is ministered to me by Bob Dylan. It goes like this. I gaze into the doorway of temptation's angry flame, and every time I pass that way, I always hear my name. That's what life is like, isn't it? Doesn't it feel that way all the time? That there is this doorway that you have to gaze into, and you are hearing your name? He tests us. He teaches us. Oftentimes, he doesn't remove the false God. Go to the next, I gaze into the doorway of temptation's angry flame, and every time I pass that way, I always hear my name. Then onward in my journey, I come to understand that every hair is numbered like every grain of sand. So what does the song do? The song does the same thing that the book of Judges does. It understands sin and the temptation to sin in light of the sovereignty of God. That is the goodness and power of God. It is not beyond his purview. And he is going to use this. He doesn't author it, but he uses it for redemptive purposes in your life and in the lives of others. So what do I do now with all of this brokenness that I suffer from? All of these dashed hopes and dreams and all of these struggles and heartaches, what do I do with all of that? I pour it into my vocation, into my studying, into my preaching, into my teaching, into my counseling, into my discipling. I take all of that and I pour it into my vocation. And that's what you should do as well, whatever your vocation is. And your vocation ultimately is that of a follower of Jesus, a child of God. And how is that being played out if you are a doctor, a bricklayer, an engineer, an accountant, whatever it is that you are? How is all of that brokenness being played out, and how is God using that in your vocation, which encompasses beyond, so everything beyond your job as well? How is that being played out in your whole life? How is God using your broken life in the broken lives of others? If God hasn't healed me, perhaps I can help heal someone else. How does it work? Everyone is weak. Everyone sins. Everyone is subject to temptation. Everyone stumbles. Not everyone wants to talk about it. Let's put it this way. Not everyone will talk about it. I think ultimately everyone does want to talk about it. Everyone wants to open up about it, but they don't think they can. They don't know what you're going to think about them. And so when we struggle, and when we find God in the struggle, we open up the possibility for others to struggle well and to open up about that and to struggle in the context of community, not in isolation. So, the place where you are tempted the most, the place where you struggle the most, the place where you hurt the most, may be the place that you have the most to offer. Jacob encountered the Lord on the river Jabbok, and the Lord wounded him in the hip and then blessed him and changed his name to Israel so that Israel would know that it is to be a wounded nation. Is it any wonder then that the Messiah of Israel is wounded beyond recognition? By his wounds, we are healed. By his wounds, he blesses us. By our wounds, we bless others. By our wounds, we open up the possibility for others to discover the crucified love of the Savior. Make your wounds available to the community so that the people in the community might be healed. Sin, in the end, ends up being a tool of God. God doesn't author it, God uses it. Therefore, don't serve sin, make sin serve you. Let sin drive you to God. Let sin form your relationship with God. God just might be leaving that in your life in order for you to know him. God tests us and teaches us so that we may know him. And that's what we learned this morning. God tests us and teaches us so that we might know him. He tests us so that we might return to him, and he teaches us that we might engage in spiritual warfare. He teaches us that we might take up a sword for our own sake and for the sake of others. All ultimately for the sake that we might know him, that we might draw near to him. So if you have been denied the healing and the deliverance that you have craved, perhaps God is whispering to you, come closer. Come closer. In Thornton Wilder's play, The Angel That Troubled the Waters, the physician who suffered from the melancholy longed to be healed, but the angel prevented him and said to him, "Physician, draw back." And then someone else got into the pool first and was healed. But here's what the angel said to the physician. "Without your wounds, where would your power be? It is your melancholy that makes your low voice tremble into the hearts of men and women. The very angels themselves cannot persuade the wretched and blundering children on earth, as can one human being broken on the wheels of living. In love's service, only wounded soldiers can serve. Physician, draw back. And then the man who was healed emerges from the pool and he approaches the physician. Get this. The man says to the physician, "Please come with me. It is only an hour to my home. My son is lost in dark thoughts. I do not understand him, and only you have ever lifted his mood. Only an hour. There is also my daughter. Since her child died, she sits in the shadow. She will not listen to us, but she will listen to you." Have you been broken on the wheels of living? You haven't been delivered. You haven't been healed. Ah, you're a wounded soldier then. And in love service, only wounded soldiers can serve. Maybe you can heal somebody else. Amen.